because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, My God, we know thee. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue him. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, that they may be cut off. Thy calf, O Samaria, hath cast thee off. Mine anger is kindled against them. How long will it be ere they attain to innocency? For from Israel was it also the workman made it. Therefore it is not God, but the calf of Samaria shall be broken in pieces. For they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. It hath no stalk, the bud shall yield no meal. If so be it yield, the strangers shall swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now shall they be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Yea, though they have hired among the nations, now will I gather them, and they shall sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes. Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. I have written to him the great things of my law, but they were counted as a strange thing. They sacrifice flesh for the sacrifices of mine offerings, and eat it, but the Lord accepteth them not. Now will he remember their iniquity and visit their sins. They shall return to Egypt. For Israel hath forgotten his Maker, and buildeth temples, and Judah hath multiplied fenced cities. But I will send a fire upon his cities, and it shall devour the palaces thereof. God will bless to us the reading of his word. Now, we're continuing in chapter 7 and chapter 8, and my purpose today is really more to give a summary of what we have in chapter 7. Not so much detail, maybe, but a few verses we'll look at in more detail. I'm not sure if you can read that top section on this slide, but it's really just the first two verses of chapter 7. When I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, for they commit falsehood, and the thief cometh in, and the troop of robbers spoileth without. They consider not in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own doings have beset them about. They are before my face. So these first two verses deal with the sin of Israel, and then the rest of the chapter, we're going to look at basically a summary of Israel under the four images that are there, the four metaphors, if you will, the four similes. I know they're not the same thing, but there's a little bit of metaphor and a little bit of simile in there. So we're going to just first of all think of this little phrase, their own doings have beset them about. Be encircled in sin. The word beset means to surround, to envelop. It means to turn around, but I believe in the context has the idea of being surrounded, to be encircled in sin. I wonder if you have ever thought of what it means to be encircled in sin, to be beset. And this is to be beset by their own doings. This is not, you know, we sometimes think of sin is all around us, and of course that's true. As we look out in the world, we're surrounded by sin. This is being surrounded by their own sin. A few thoughts on it. Was thinking that possibly this could mean the fact that their conscience is with them at all times. There's the sting of conscience. As they would think of their sin, they would be caused to think of it. You know, the sinner can seek to hide his sins, but conscience keeps coming back to gnaw away at him and to bring that sin to remembrance and accuse him of his guilt. I don't know, I suppose that every one of us knows what it is to have a guilty conscience from time to time. When you have a busy day, maybe it's not bothering you, but when you go to lay your head on the pillow at night, the thought comes in, I didn't do what was right, I did what was wrong. You wake up in the morning, first thing that comes into your mind is, I did wrong. Guilty conscience, probing and prodding us. It's not a good way to live. You know, we said something to a brother or a sister or someone that we oughtn't to have said, and it's bothering us. You know, on the first day, conscience is strong, and maybe in a little bit we've put it off, and it's not the right time to apologize today. Today wouldn't be a good day, and tomorrow, it's really not that good of a day either. And before you know it, we're thinking, yeah, it would be the right thing to do, but so much time's gone by, it's sort of like opening up old wounds, and it can't be a good thing. You know, least said, soonest mended kind of thing. And it just goes on. It's not a good way to live with a guilty conscience. The apostle could write in Acts 14 and 26, herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. And again in Romans 14 and 22, happy is he that condemneth not himself in that thing which he alloweth. I believe the idea is having those convictions as well, but that's connected with the conscience. So we can be surrounded by our own conscience. But we can be surrounded too, and this guilt that's brought before us can be seen, and we can be enveloped in it because of the force of habit. Sin by repetition grows into habit. Habit becomes a ruling power, and a rooted habit becomes a governing principle. I've got the little example of Delilah with Samson and how she not only left him without strength, but left him bound. Habits have a way of binding us. I was thinking of a time when I was in my office a number of years ago, and I just came up to the front where the reception area was, and a lady, a client, was just leaving, and as she was going out the door, another lady was coming in. And after the door closed behind the exiting lady, the last one who came in said to the receptionist, "Boy, that woman has the sharpest tongue in town." I think probably the second woman, maybe. If the first statement was true, the second woman was a pretty close second. But anyway, that's not a way for a Christian to be remembered. If we have a particular negative habit that begins to characterize us, and people know us as the person with the sharpest tongue in town, wouldn't it be nice to be known as the most gracious person in town? Isn't that what a Christian should be like? We can be surrounded by our own habits that seem to take over. But not only this thing of conscience and the force of habit, but the influence of example. The doings of men live before them in their effects upon others. The evil that men do lives after them. The apostle could write to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4 and 12, let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity. This idea of the influence, the power of influence. No man is an island, they say, unto himself. There are others all around us that are watching us, learning from our example. Just at lunchtime, unsolicited, someone said to me as they were looking at the children and they were saying, It's wonderful to see them growing up. And you know, you can see in these little ones, you can see the character traits of their parents. You know, that's wonderful when what we see is good. But what about when we don't see what's so good? They're learning from us. And we can see that power of influence all around us. And if it's negative, it also surrounds us. That negative influence. We see what we've been teaching and the influence that we've had on others. It's growing up in front of us and it surrounds us. I was reminded of something I read some time ago about a man who was preparing a Father's Day message, and as he was preparing the message, his little 5 or 6 year old boy came into the study where he was preparing, and he came up to him and he said, "Daddy, when I grow up, I'm going to be just like you." And in some ways that's flattering, in some ways it's scary. We want to say to the younger ones, no, set your sights so much higher. But what right have we to ask them to aim higher than what we were prepared to aim? Let's remember that the influence of example surrounds us. I was thinking as well of Simeon and Levi, two brothers that egged each other on. You can think about that for yourself. Not only the sting of conscience and the force of habit and the influence of example, but the consequences of natural law, things that start out just in our conscience, progress to become, if we don't deal with it, becomes a habit. And over time, we can see that growing up around us eventually results in the punishment that follows sin as a natural order. Galatians 6 and 7, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." Thinking of being beset around, we recall the words of Hebrews 12 and 1, where foreseeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. The answer is to look off unto Jesus. And that word easily beset is very similar to the Hebrew, but I understand that this could equally be translated, it skillfully surrounds us, reminds us of what the devil is doing. He has us as a target. So the balance of the chapter gives four images to show what God thinks of those who would confess his name, while they nevertheless continue in their rebellious way of life. First is an oven. It's a half-baked cake. A dove, a silly dove, the scripture says, and a deceitful or crooked bow, which is a faulty weapon. The oven may speak of the intense fires that drive the sinner, eventually consume him. The heart burns with the fire of passion, and indulgence and flattery furnish the fuel. Just thinking of, in the context of this chapter, these people were taking the king, and verse 5 refers to the day of the king, whether that was his birthday, whether that was a coronation day, some special day. The princes have made him sick with bottles of wine. He stretched out his hand with scorners, and as men will do, they were egging each other on, one thing leading to another. Maybe one daring one to go on. And when people see me do something, they're encouraged to do it as well, but they're also maybe encouraged to take it a step further. So the sin is as a furnace or an oven of fire, but it's a cake not turned. Reminds us of the Laodicean church, Revelation chapter 3, if God would spit out that which was lukewarm, how much more repugnant must Israel be to God at this stage, since she was overcooked on one side and not cooked at all on the other. She did not even seem to be aware of her condition. Possibly the overcooked might be the formalism that she was engaged in, going through all of these sacrifices and the rituals, but her heart was not right. G. Campbell Morgan wrote, "Signs of decadence which are patent to others are undiscovered by ourselves, and we go on and on and on, the victims of ebbing strength, spiritually and morally becoming degenerate without knowing it. We're blind to the signs which are self-evident to onlookers. There is no condition which is more perilous to our highest well-being than this of unconscious decadence." I wonder what it means to be spiritually degenerate. Again, consider Samson. He wist not that the Lord was departed from him. Then there's the silly or the simple dove. I understand that word silly means that. The dove, easily deceived and senseless, without heart is what the expression is from the scriptures, without understanding or wisdom, and God says, "I will bring them down." Simplicity is not bad in itself. It can be good or bad. But it's according to some other qualities to which it opens the mind and which lead it to good or mislead it to evil. We can think of the Lord Jesus telling the disciples that they were to go out and be as wise as serpents and as harmless. And that's really the idea of simple. Harmless, simple as doves. That's a good sense. But in this case, it's not a good sense. And we can see from the context that it's silly, it's simple to boast of knowledge without wisdom. That's without heart. They had knowledge. I wonder if that can characterize us sometimes. We have the knowledge, but we don't have the wisdom to go with it. But it's silly to depend on human aid and to forsake divine aid. So they were calling and going to Egypt, as the context would indicate. We think of Phil and Trina and their family and how they've accepted the call of God and they've gone out and they're living by faith. Some of us might be tempted to say, that's kind of scary. To count on God. Isn't it more silly to depend on human aid? Some of us maybe have a paycheck coming in every 2 weeks or whenever. It gets pretty comfortable when you can count on that. And this living by faith, that could be scary. Well, I don't think it's scary to count on God. I am reminded of a man I know when he was a senior officer in a company, had an important position, reasonably well paid in consequence of that. But, you know, the board decided that they didn't really need him anymore. But they're trying to figure out how to get rid of him. Now, he had a stressful job to begin with, and he understood that they were trying to do what's referred to as constructive dismissal, trying to build a case. Well, it added to his stress, and one day he had a heart attack at work. They called the ambulance quick, rushed him to the hospital. The company fired him for abandoning his post. Now, I'm sure that wouldn't stand up in law, but loyalty of this world just doesn't exist. If you're not useful to them, they'll make a decision, and sometimes even when you are, you can't count on anything from the world. silly to depend on human aid, to forsake divine aid. Silly in not discovering the danger. The net had been spread. It was visible. It was open. And Israel just refused to see the danger and the destruction that lay ahead. And the last one is a deceitful or a warped bow. Not only useless, but downright dangerous. Someone who trusts in a weapon like this will fall to his enemies. No matter how good the aim, the arrow will always miss the mark. We know that Israel did nothing about her sin and she perished in it. The answer is to heed the warning of chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. We read them the other week, but here it is again. O Israel, return unto the Lord thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity. Take with you words and turn to the Lord. Say unto him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously. So will we render the calves of our lips. The essence of this is a confession of sin, an appeal to the grace of God. For sure, we don't want justice. It's the grace of God that we need. Chapter 8, Reaping the Whirlwind. It's the title I put on it. Thinking of this verse 7, which is in the center of the chapter. So they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. It hath no stock, the bud shall yield no meal. If so be it yield, the strangers shall swallow it up. And that verse basically, I think, is a summation of the chapter. We'll go on to look at verse 14, which really explains some of the balance of what's in the chapter. We'll look at an overview of the verses entering it. But this basically is the heart of chapter 8. Sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. I don't know if you've ever been in a tornado or a hurricane. I was in one once, but I have to confess I'm probably, if I was trying to impress you with the tremendous power and the devastation that a hurricane, for example, can cause, I'd probably be the wrong person because it was quite a storm, but Margaret and I slept through it. It hadn't come when we went to bed at night, and when we woke up in the morning, the sun was shining. We were in London, England, and this happened. I just Googled for the fun of it here the other night, just to see if there was anything on about, and I Googled hurricanes that hit London, England. The top of the list was one that's called the Great, Wikipedia, the Great Storm of 1987. It's at the top of the list. It was a huge hurricane that hit London, and we slept through it. So there was a lot of damage following it, but whirlwinds, hurricanes, tornadoes, they can do a lot of damage. I can't explain what they are or how they happen. I know it has something to do with warm ocean water on the surface, and it has something to do with low pressure and the rotation of the earth and a number of different things. I'm sure that scientists know much more about it now than they did in 1987, but I can't tell you much about hurricanes, but I can tell you a little bit about spiritual whirlwinds. What causes them? The small things. Sowing the wind. Something that's empty. Something that's considered in the scriptures as vanity. It's just small things. Well, maybe not so small. Israel hath forgotten his maker. Verse 14. It means to forget, to ignore. It's not intellectually forgetting. No one really forgets God. Romans chapter 1 would tell us that. We know about God. We know that he's there, but we can ignore him, cease to care that he's there. Forgetting God. Israel, of all nations, should never have done that. I've got a few passages here, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 23. Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you. Deuteronomy 6 and 10, it shall be when the Lord thy God shall have brought thee into the land. Verse 12 says, beware, lest thou forget the Lord. Deuteronomy 8 and 10, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God. And verse 14, thine heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt. Verses 18, 19, and 20 of that same chapter. Thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for he it is that giveth thee power to get wealth, and he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. And it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day, that ye shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroyeth before your face, so shall ye perish, because ye would not be obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God. But five things resulted from their forgetting God. It's as though Moses looked down the corridor of time and he saw the great danger to the people of God, and he warned them over and over about forgetting God, but they didn't. I don't know if these things are resulting from their forgetting God or if they're really evidences that they forgot God. Either way, the breaking of God's covenant, verses 1 to 3. So this is a summary of this chapter. The choice of kings and other leaders apart from God's direction. Idolatry, verses 4 to 6. The formation of alliances with ungodly nations, verses 8 to 10. The construction of false altars, verses 11 to 13. So the first few verses, set the trumpet to thy mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, my God, we know thee. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. That's God. The psalmist tells us that. The enemy shall pursue him. It's the breaking of God's covenant. The text combines the thought of breaking God's covenant with that of rebellion against God's law. It says we cannot call God God if we don't have obedience to him. Reminds us of what the Lord said. Luke 6 and 46, why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? And his response to those who said they knew him in Matthew 7, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils? Then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. I've got a little reference here. You probably can't see it. Isaiah 29, verse 13. It's just for my sake to remind me to remind you about Isaiah 29 and 13. It's a little verse that talks about these. This people draweth nigh unto me with their mouths and with their lips, but their heart is far from me. The tone of the passage indicates that God hates the hypocrisy of it all. And then verse 4, the first half of verse 4, actually, they have made set up kings, but not by me. They've made princes, and I knew it not. One of the great gifts of God to any people is an upright and godly leadership. Those who follow their own wisdom inevitably get what they deserve. And a little point to note that none of the kings of Israel since the defection from the house of David was the anointed of the Lord. We have in Hosea chapter 13 coming up in the will of the Lord. We'll see this later. I will be thy king. This is the Lord speaking. I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities? And thy judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and princes. I gave thee a king in mine anger and took him away in my wrath. And then there's the section of verses 4-6 on idolatry. Remove far from thee thy cattle, Samaria. Verse 5, the Authorized translates it as, thy calf, O Samaria, hath cast thee off. In a previous verse, Israel, verse 3, Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. Now this, their idol, God, is casting them off. How long will they be incapable of purity? Idolatry is a question of what we give our time and allegiance to, rather than what we say. We can have words that are also good sounding, but who do we give our allegiance to? The next section is the formation of alliances with ungodly nations, verses 8-10. Ephraim hath hired lovers or sold himself among the nations. It was an unnatural alliance, a wild ass alone by himself. It's an unfaithful alliance. She had hired lovers. It was a destructive alliance. They shall sorrow. They will pay the price. The sympathies and aspirations of the new man are with God and not the world. It's the takeaway for you and I. Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, verses 11, 12, and 13, this construction of false altars. In multiplying altars, they were opposing the commandment of God, Deuteronomy 12 and verse 5. They were strengthening the habit of sin from 1 Kings 12 and verse 30. See, in multiplying altars that weren't intended to be, that weren't instructed of God, to have one was one thing, but to multiply them just strengthened that habit of sin, and it increased their own punishment. Now will He, the Lord, visit their sins. I wanted to spend a minute or two on this verse 12. I have written to Him the great things of my law, but they were counted as a strange thing. In despising the law, the great things of my law were counted as a strange thing, a foreign thing, an alien thing. It's not hard for us to imagine how Jeroboam and Israel must have said that these prohibitions of idolatry, the commandments to not commit idolatry, they were good. They were necessary when the heathen were in the land, or maybe while their forefathers were just out of Egypt. After all, they'd had that strong influence in Egypt. So these commandments, they were necessary for then. But it's not so good now. We don't need it now. It was good in its time. It had its day. But it's foreign to them. It's foreign to us, they may have said. It's no longer applicable. Can't you think of some Christians today who may be saying things like that? We're under grace, we're not under law. Well, we are under grace, that's for sure. But they would take grace as being the liberty that would be ours. They would turn it to license. They would say that grace is not so strict as the law. The teachings of the Lord Jesus, of course, they took us past the law, didn't they? But we are under grace, but that doesn't mean license. Can you hear some say that maybe the liberty of the gospel is freedom? Not from sin, but from duty. Don't really need to do those things. Can you hear some say that certain things belong to the early Christians? See, it's foreign. They were surrounded by heathen as well, or to the first times of the gospel, or to the days when it or the early church was persecuted, but not now. We don't need those things that the apostle wrote about. You can hear some of them say that riches were dangerous when people could scarcely have them, but not now when everyone has them. The world was perilous when it was the Christian's open foe, but not now. Not when it would be friends with us and have us friends with it. We need to win the world, we can hear them say. We need to be friends with the world. Love not the world was a precept for times when the world hated us, but not now, when it is all around us and steals our hearts. And you see how so much of Christianity today is really just like Israel was then. I've written to him the great things of my law. But they were counted as a strange thing. They, in verse 13, they were offering, some say, lifeless sacrifices. I've copied this from Dr. Constable. The Hebrew word basar, translated meat, is in the emphatic position before the verb. All of this is kind of Greek or Hebrew to me, but it indicates that God regarded the sacrifices as nothing more than meat. There was absolutely no sacrificial value. In verse 14, Israel hath forgotten his maker. Judgment flows from a forgetfulness of God. Not that intellectual forgetfulness, that ignoring, that ceasing to count as important, to ceasing to include in our life. The word for temples is really a word that means bigness or spaciousness, and sometimes that characterizes us today, doesn't it? We can see it around us. It's not to say that we just long for little things. We would like to see much of God's blessing, not a little of it, but so many times people get occupied with bigness. We hear of these mega churches down in the States, and we wonder how much of God is about them. Not to be critical, just when we see bigness, we need to be on our guard against thinking that bigness is a sign of God's blessing. It's often in the smallest things that the greatest blessing is given. We're reminded of that still small voice. I'm going to leave you with this verse from Psalm 127, verse 1. Except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Thank you for listening. We'll ask God's blessing as we part.